This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Well, it's some
picks. Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here with what should be a fun and fairly informal edition of The Bix Show, as I am joined by my good friend, wrestling historian, writer of the... I was trying to figure out the best word to use it for that, but I guess just writer of the Lucha Report every week on... Where is it? DeathValleyDriver.com forums. I think on the WrestlingObserver.com site somewhere, among other things. Host now of the excellent Exile on Bad Street podcast, among other things I'm probably forgetting, the one and only Chris Zellner.
Yeah, the Lucha Report is not just a weekly thing. It's
Did I say weekly?
Yeah. Hey, whatever.
I know, but it's not weekly. I don't know why I said that.
That's all right. You know, and of all the places to find that, the Death Valley Driver site is the best because that's where you get all the posters that I've compiled to go in the report. And I know last week they had the Dia de los Niños week, or the kids week. And there was, I had over 215 some posters on there. So yeah, it was insane. It's insane. But, yeah, it's a labor of love and I love doing it. And like I said, you know, I'm on the Observer, and you know, I'm wherever. So type my name and you'll see my stuff on all these different websites that people have gotten. So I'm all over the place.
Yep. And placetobenation.com for the Exile on Bad Street podcast, which I was on, I guess it was a few weeks ago, and I'll be back on soon for a sequel to the episode we did along with Dylan.
And have one go off today.
Yes. So it is. Why don't you plug it?
I'll go ahead and plug it now. Get it out of the way. I was joined by Robert Bahari, Alfredo Esparza from LuchaWorld.com, and the Cubs fan. And we did a special Lucha podcast talking about the art of the Technico and what we think makes a great Technico. We go over the different styles and traits, and then we give examples of specific workers and even sometimes specific matches. And as a little side thing at the end, we go over, you know, what we thought about the first quarter of a year in Lucha Libre. So it's a really good show. I suggest everyone listen to it.
Yep. I did not get to listen to that yet. How long is this one?
It's the shortest one we've done so far, but it still clocks in a little over 2 hours. So it's not a marathon session, but, you know, it's still a good show.
I will try to listen to that probably tomorrow during my various podcast listening rounds. So today, I just kind of wanted to have you on anyway, but I figured the most fun thing to talk about, and we probably won't stick completely to this, but we have both been kind of making our way through all sorts of old newsletters and stuff lately because, I mean, the biggest reason is that Jason Campbell, who's a longtime wrestling historian and, you know, all-time insider fan and all that, he has long been the owner and operator of ProWrestlingHistory.com, which is, I guess, would probably be the longest standing of those various results sites and stuff, right? I can't remember anything that I used before it.
I remember going to that site a good 15 years ago. I mean, that back when it was mainly just supercards and stuff like that, tournaments. And then he started adding, like, the complete Mid-South Coliseum and complete ECW, complete Smoky Mountain and stuff like that. Yeah, he was the precursor to what Graham would do for the history of WWE.com. So yeah, Campbell's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and I think it was called Wrestling Supercards and Tournaments back then. And I think the thing that I remember he got like the most, because his site always, it was never under the radar, but it wasn't necessarily something that people pushed a lot. I remember he got a lot of attention when it was one of the WCW tag title tournaments. The early 99 one. And do you remember it was like the really complicated one where the outsiders kept interfering and stuff?
Yeah, that one, that was the one of the ones, and I want to say that the singles title tournament that year too had some like confusion involved in it as well. Well, it's, you know, 1999 WCW was a complete cluster. So, right. You know.
Right. But he figured out an actual functional bracket for that tournament.
Yeah, which in wrestling, functional brackets are extremely rare.
But, I mean, you have to think, because it's like, teams were left and were reinserted back, and I could never figure out how he actually came up with it, but he actually figured out how that whole tournament worked, and he actually made something presentable out of it. And he's always been a cool guy to deal with in terms of answering questions by email and just trading results or whatever. And anyway, we were talking about him because he has had on his site now for the past couple of years, and if my voice went out because I went away from the mic because I dropped my phone, he has had for the past couple of years a link on the front page of ProWrestlingHistory.com, which is classic newsletter downloads, and that takes you to a page on his site that then links to a download folder on Google Drive full of all sorts of zip files, full of different PDFs of all sorts of older wrestling newsletters. And really his only ground rules that he sets, and I think if anyone emailed him, he would add it to this list, is that he's not including newsletters where the back issues are still available from the publisher. So Torch, Observer, Figure Four Weekly, he lists Whatever Happened To There, which I didn't know. Scott does still sell those. I guess he sells the collections. And so it's like, I've barely looked at a lot of these. I mean, part of it's because a lot of them are just results, but then that's in your wheelhouse. So both of us have just been kind of slowly going over these, I guess, especially the last few months. Like, I don't know why I didn't really dig into it until recently, because he's had these up for a couple of years now, but there is so much interesting stuff here, and so much of a lot of it is, like, older, like, pre-Observer, but a lot of it is post-Observer. It's just, there's so much different stuff to go through.
Yeah, it's taken me longer to go through this than I actually want to, because there's so much stuff. And like you said, I go through the results, and it's tough. You know, I've been building this results archive I've had for well over 10 years now. And between other stuff that I work on, like the Lucha Report, it's extremely, I wouldn't say stressful, but it takes up a lot of time whenever I do it. My hands are only good for so long these days. I got to that point where I'm pretty sure I got carpal tunnel and whatever. So I can only type certain things. Like right now, one of the main ones I'm working on is a Paul Abinante Spinny Toehold newsletter from back in the day. And it's 35 pages each shot of nothing but results. So I'm having to go and check, do I have this? And do I have this in my other file? Because I have one big file I used to work with, and now I'm working with a system where I'm trying to do it by promotion instead of just doing it in date order. So, you know, try to have a split promotion list. And yeah, it's crazy, man. And yeah, there's so much stuff, you know, like I said, there is some stuff in the 60s. I know. And there's stuff from early 2000s I know of. So, it spans, you know, 5 decades. This information is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and some of these individual newsletters even span decades. I mean, I'm looking at Tom Burke's Global Wrestling News Service, and he has issue number 1, which is October 1975, and the latest issue he has in this folder is issue 169, which is March 1990.
And Tom Burke, you know, I'm friends with him on Facebook, and he's still every day he posts like different results from that day. So he's still doing stuff. Maybe he's not doing his newsletter anymore, but he's still actively into doing stuff, you know, involving wrestling.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm friends with him on Facebook. I need to friend him then. I dealt with him a little bit, like on eBay. He used to sell under, I think his username was K Fabian. And yeah. Wait a second. Do my friend Tom Burke Springfield, Massachusetts, or Tom Burke Springfield, Massachusetts public figure?
I think I would go with the top one.
Okay. Don't even want to know how that one came about. So he was selling all sorts of stuff, old newsletters and just random, you know, programs like in these grab bags. And I bought a couple of them. They were really cool. But like he would throw in like printed out wrestling classics threads that he found interesting, which I thought was a little weird. But
I tell you about Tom Burke. what I found early on was wrestling classics were basically where I started all this from. In fact, you know, if you go back to the older forums on that, I was posting results on that site that I found like in 2001, you know, and basically stuff I found on the WWLI papers, J. Michael Kenyon, and stuff like that. And Burke, I would find through Google News Groups, which in fact, they went in Google News Groups before they bought it. Before it was Google, actually. Well, it was the news groups. And Tom Burke would post, I don't know if he did it or somebody else would, put the results in there from certain newsletters. Like I remember there was the whole one from one of the months in 79, I remember. And it was all these cool results I'd never seen before. And that was one of the early things that got me into collecting the results and saying, like, look at all these cool matches. And man, I wish I could have seen this. So yeah, it's definitely cool to see those old results. It sparked a whole new interest for me.
Right, and Tom's a guy who has been just collecting stuff, all sorts of different wrestling stuff for decades. I mean, I think he, on YouTube, there's a bunch of videos of someone coming over to his house and just taking like extensive videos of his wrestling collection.
Yeah, Tom's one of these guys. He's like Dave, you know, he's still a fan of the business, even now, and you know, just a total historian. There's a few of them that's still left. You know, a lot of the guys have gotten out of it or have passed away, sadly. But it's always great to see these guys still have a passion for it. Like Yoey, you know, that's another guy.
Yeah. Is Bob Bryla still around? The guy, Dr. Bob Bryla, the guy who was, he was involved with one of the Halls of Fame. I think he might be involved with the Upstate New York one.
I have no clue if he's still around or not. I really don't know. I mean, there's so many guys like that over the years that you kind of like, once they get out of the scene, you just lose track of them.
Yeah. And I am looking at Tom's Facebook page now. He posts a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, he does. He's a wealth of knowledge. So you know, I get called a wrestling historian, and I appreciate that title. But guys like that, you know, make me look minor league.
So if someone wants to take a look at a lot of the stuff we're going to be talking about, and it's right there for the taking for free on Jason's website at prowrestlinghistory.com.
One thing you got to watch out for, and I had to email Jason about this, and he was really great about this. Was if you have like Norton 360 or anything with Norton, if you try to download some of the zip files, it will come up, you know, with the big red X. But don't worry about it. That's just for going to the site that the file is linked off to. It's not the file itself.
Well, so they're, the on files Google, are safe. They're on Google Drive, so I don't even know why that would be a problem. But yeah, I mean, I'm on a Mac, so I've never had that problem. But yeah, I mean, that's good to know then.
If you have the Norton 360 or something like that, don't worry about it. Just go ahead and download them. They're clean. It's just the gateway site popped up the red X, for whatever reason.
Big red X. Yeah, used to be a staple of pro wrestling broadcast.
Yeah, WWF television.
Were they the only one who did that?
The red X, I think they were the only one that did it. So other promotions would do like a block or something, or they would pixelize it. Or they would do what the funky thing that Crockett used to do, where they would, like, the whole screen would go black with like a yellow. It was a funky, like, psychedelic look. You remember that from the Abdullah angle with Wahoo?
Not
from like 81, where Wahoo and Piper were feuding. And, Piper brought Abdullah in to take care of Wahoo, and Wahoo's wrestled some job, I can't remember who it was. Abby comes in and starts attacking him and busts him open. and the screen went black with like everybody in yellow silhouettes, and it looked like it was totally psychedelic.
Oh, the thing that they would do on, so the same thing they would do on the Crockett shows, like before the match.
Yes, the same
thing.
So
they did that to the wrestlers to censor the blood.
Yes. Yes. It's crazy watching that stuff because you have some of these shows that would just, I mean, the camera's almost basically in the wound. And then you got this where, you know, just any slight hint of blood and poof. It's weird how watch out. And then they would show like house show footage of the, it's the same promotion now. Show house show footage and you see blood there. It was just a weird deal. I don't know.
Well, sometimes it made it seem more violent if you had it censored. Like, if you look at the Ron Bass Brutus Beefcake angle, which was one of the last times they did the Big Red X on WWF TV, on how it aired here, I mean, it looks like the most violent thing ever. You know, you see blood on the mat, you have the Big Red X as Ron Bass is digging the spurs into Beefcake's head, and you think it's the most violent thing ever, and then there you see the way it aired in Canada without the Big Red X, and he really didn't bleed much.
Well, the thing about the Wahoo deal was Jim Crockett comes running out there and said, take it off the air, you know, so you got the boss coming out there wanting to take this off television because it's too violent. No, it wasn't that one. That was one where Bobby Duncombe and Blackjack Mulligan had this match where they were bleeding. It was a brass knuckles match, and Crockett come out there and said, We're stopping this right now. We're going to take it off the air. I don't think they actually blocked up the blood anything, but he just said it's too violent for television. Weird.
At least it was for the angle, unlike the way Ed Whalen would do it in Calgary.
Yeah.
Or he would just cut the match off. It would just, this is too violent for television. He doesn't like his wrestling like that.
Yeah, God forbid we show anything complete on Stampede Wrestling Television.
No. Well, that was, a lot of that, though, at least the way it started, was just how low a budget they were on, that they didn't have any budget to actually edit the show. So at least that started with them just recording in progress and then just kind of doing the most bare-bones edit they could because they didn't have money to really do a full edit of the show. That's how that started. I don't exactly know why it kept going into the 80s and stuff, but that's why.
Yeah, it makes sense. If you're going to do your stuff, then you must do job matches.
Well, and if it's the house show, I mean, I get not wanting to give away the whole house show.
Yeah, you know, but it just sucks that we got this later on, you know, with Crockett and with Watts at times, you know, where they're, we're out of time, you know. they would, like, show up. I watched the match today. It was a Dusty Rhodes and Bobby Eaton match for the U.S. title. And it was on Crockett Television. It's around January 1988. And the match starts up, and then, like, 2 minutes later, we're out of time. We'll see you next week. You know, no, it was Superpowers against Midnights. Superpowers against Midnights match. It wasn't a singles match.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it will show you we'll show you the rest of it next week.
And they never did.
They never did.
I never got the whole wrestling obsession with pretending the shows were all live.
Yeah,
obviously weren't.
Yeah, exactly. You know, whenever they would go to commercial break during mid match, and when they come back, you didn't miss the chunk of the match. Basically, they taped it to air. So as the commercials were going, that's where probably how much of the match you lost in a lot of ways. That time of the match.
Well, it depended on the territory.
Yeah, it did.
Like, sometimes, like, on some of those UWF shows we have where they have where it's the raw footage and not the TV show, you can tell they only cut out, like, 30 seconds to a minute.
And sometimes it would sync up naturally. You would be right where you left off.
Right.
Which World Class would do that a lot. So.
Yeah.
Not everybody did it like that, but. Yeah, it gets annoying, especially when you have a great match and you kind of want to, you know, like on these 80s projects we do, if it's a good chunk of it's clipped out, you can't nominate a match because you're missing too much.
You need wrestling.
Yeah. You know, and you got the, if you're not taping over the stuff,
yeah,
which a lot of these promotions did, like a bunch of idiots, you know, we had this problem. So. If they knew what they know now, you know, make sure, you got to think they wouldn't have done it because that's how much money they would have made for some of these libraries.
Well, it's interesting to think about which promoters were the most forward-looking. Like, I think it would be Vince Sr. and Vince Jr. would have to be at the top of the list, at least in North America.
Paul Bosch.
Paul Bosch, I would say. But they kept their – well, he – well, I don't know exactly how much he kept because it seemed – I think – what's his Bruce Tharp was saying that it's about 500 hours, which seems like it's a lot, but I don't think it's a lot in the grand scheme of all of Houston wrestling.
Paul Bosch, I think his shows were an hour and a half. So you do the math on that.
But you have to take out the footage from the other promotion, though.
Yeah.
If it's just the Houston stuff and not the Mid-South or South – or whatchamacallit?
Southwest.
San Antonio. Yeah, San Antonio.
Or even going back period. Or go back to the days when they were using Dallas.
Well, I don't think they ever aired the Dallas TV. I think they just aired the Houston shows.
Well, everyone really had their own TV.
No, I think everyone had their own TV.
Yeah, we really don't know because that happened well before, you know, that was like 77,
yeah.
76, 77 before they split off. But, yeah, back in that time period, Dallas was like the main office and everybody and the other parts, other Texas offices other than the Funks would use Dallas's talent.
Right.
So it was a whole big loop. Houston was on Friday and Dallas was on Sunday. Fort Worth was on Monday and San Antonio, I think, was on Wednesday. So, yeah, it was just one big old loop.
So going back to some of the newsletter stuff, I mean, I'm just kind of looking through some of it a little as we talk, and you've got all your different types of newsletters, both, I mean, pre and post Observer. Pre-Observer, I think, and maybe a little, I don't know, what would you say about this as far as like how much were just results, and then when did you start to have stuff similar to the Observer or stuff that had more clippings or whatever? Because like for me, I guess partially because I know you're looking at the results, but in general, because it feels almost too overwhelming, I like to look at the stuff that either has original writing or has clippings of news articles and programs and lineups from ads and stuff. That's kind of what I like to look for. But you kind of have to go through a lot of newsletters and figure out which are which to find some of that stuff.
You could tell as the time goes on that's when you get more news in there. It becomes more of a newsletter. You know, from the early days, it's basically all results. And maybe you'll get some like artistic drawings, which are pretty cool. And a lot of these sometimes you'll get like the big write-ups of fans that went to the show, like the live reports, which are also pretty cool to read. Like there's one I was looking at the other day. It was 1971 newsletter. I can't remember who it was. And it was in detail road shows from this guy on a weekend work going to the AWA shows, whether it was Chicago, Milwaukee, and you know, St. Paul, mm-hmm. and giving detailed results of all these different matches and stuff. And it was pretty cool to read stuff like that. And you get like, you know, you'll see names in there, you know, people you know, like people that would become wrestlers, or become like referee. Like one you'll see a lot is named Brian Hildebrand.
Yep.
And who become Mark Curtis, the referee for Smoky Mountain and WCW down the road. But he was a prevalent character in these newsletters, was sending results in. Paul Heyman is in a lot of these as a photographer. Jim Cornette's in a ton of them as a photographer, you know, because he was the main one in Louisville in that area. We go to Memphis. Dave, you see Dave in a lot of these, you know, the beginning and
even later on, as maybe we'll talk about in a little bit, like he'd kind of randomly write for some other newsletters, even after the Observer.
They're listed as contributors or, you know, just as friends, you know, and then there would be sections of the newsletters where other people could shill their newsletters and fan clubs. Basically, this all spawned off fan clubs,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. And a lot of people would get in these different fan clubs for whatever wrestler or whatever promotion, and they would trade results. You know, basically, it was the precursor for trading tapes, because there wasn't VCRs until the latter 70s, you know, and they really didn't pick up to the early 80s when they started getting cheaper. But it was much easier to trade results with your friends and trade something else, because that way you could find out what's going on.
Well, because some of them would do the audio tapes, though, too.
Yeah, audio tapes as well, yeah. In that era, you only saw your promotion. You know, if you were in, you know, New York, you basically only saw WF television.
And Florida.
Well, later on. But if you were in Atlanta, all you saw was Turner, and maybe you would catch Florida or Crockett at times. Like, I know they aired on television at different times in the 70s. But you wouldn't see what was going on in Texas or the LaBelle promotion in Los Angeles or Roy Shire in San Francisco. So it's a way to find out what's going on in wrestling around the country and in the world. I mean, there were you know, people that would send stuff from Japan, you know, different pictures, which those are always cool to look at because, yeah, you can't read Japanese, but they have real cool photos and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just it's a lot of potpourri involved in that early era. And then in the latter era, when they started putting more news out there, you know, some of it, I'm sure, came from basically from the Observer verbatim. But there would be stuff in there, too, where, you know, people would hear stuff as well. And I found stuff in there, and I hope to do a show on this down the line, and you'll probably be on it, where we talk about some of the stuff that is in these old newsletters that didn't happen. That was rumored. Like one off the top of my head was in reading one of these newsletters about how Terry Funk was supposed to go with the WWF in 1980, like in August, September 1980, he was going to do an extended run with Backlund. And for whatever reason, I think it may have been Japan commitments, it fell apart.
Okay, I really want to do that show. So
yeah, because there's a lot of stuff I've read over the years. Like, wow, you know. Like how close Vince was to buying World Class in 1984. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. You know, you read about over, you're like, wow, I never knew that.
Yeah. Anything specific?
Oh, I must say, that's just the one off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I can't remember a lot of these things. I have to go back and look at it.
Okay. Oh, so as far as like some of the names you'll see, one of the things I like is going through the membership roster of the Eddie Gilbert fan club that Terry Justice ran. And we'll talk about Terry Justice a little more in a minute. But he had was it the International Eddie Gilbert fan club, or was it just the Eddie Gilbert fan club? Because some of them were international.
I think it was international.
Okay. Well, some of them, like, wasn't it, what's his name? Johnny Legend's Blassie fan club. Wasn't that international to like differentiate it from an existing fan club or something?
I think so.
So,
and you got to remember, real quick back to Eddie Gilbert, this time period, he was just in his second year of wrestling.
Well, the fan club started, I think, before he actually debuted on Memphis TV, at least.
Yeah, when he worked in that Malden, Missouri promotion that all of them worked.
For Henry, now I'm forgetting the last name.
Yeah.
I should know this because I wrote about it recently.
And he worked as Tommy Gilbert Jr.
Well, he did on Memphis TV a little at first, too. So it's January 1, 1979 was the first issue. So yeah. Looking at the member, this is the latest issue that has a full membership roster, which is September 79. So we've got Paul Abinante, who you were mentioning earlier with the Spinning Toehold newsletter. Let's see, Tom Burke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who Rocco Buttafuoco Jr. is. Let's see. Wait, David Chappelle from Nova Scotia. Isn't there a David Chappelle in wrestling? But I didn't think he was from Canada.
Dave Chappelle, not the comedian, but
from the he was on
Wrestling
the
Classics. Yeah, he was on Wrestling Classics.
Wasn't he part of the Mid-Atlantic Memory site? Maybe.
Yes.
But
yes.
Is that the same one? I guess.
I'm thinking it is.
I didn't realize he was from Canada. I thought he was from Crockett territory.
He may have been living there at one point. I don't know.
Okay. Jim Cornette from Middletown, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Then we've got another Middletown from Middletown, Connecticut, Gary Kubeta.
Yeah, Gary Kubeta. You see his name a lot. You know, the guy from 57talk.com.
He had his own newsletter a little bit.
Had his own newsletter, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should call some of these bulletins instead of or fanzines, because yeah. I don't know how far we want to go and call some of them newsletters.
Yeah, you're right on that one.
I've seen some of the the letters he wrote to other newsletters and stuff. So someone had a scan of them online or something. I need to find it. It was interesting. And then who else do we have here? I don't know if he's on this list, if he stopped subscribing officially or something, but Luthez was an early member of the Eddie Gilbert fan club.
Yeah, Luthez was in this stuff before, you know, heavily in a lot of ways. And I know Terry Justice, you know, talks about going to his house and staying, you know, for like a weekend. Yeah. You know, so.
Oh, yeah, this one's in alphabetical order. So, yeah, he's there later. Luthez in Newport News, Virginia.
Is David Williamson on that list?
I think so. Let's see. Wilson. Actually, no David Williamson.
David Williamson's a guy who used to post on wrestling classes a lot. He was like the main historian, I would say, of the Southeastern territory, yes, especially Alabama stuff. Just a wealth of knowledge. And he posted in different aliases on Wrestling Classics.
Yes, lots of them.
But mainly they were based around his favorite wrestlers, whether it be Ken Lucas or Don Carson or whatever.
Right, one of them was Ken Carson.
Yeah, that was who he based after. And he posted all these great results. He had a lot of clippings, which he would, you know, the Terry Justice newsletter, he contributed a lot of those Southeastern clippings to that. So, yeah, he's another guy who I haven't seen him around lately, but yeah, he was another guy really was an inspiration when I first started getting into it. And another guy who, you know, we got to mention, who just passed away recently, was James Ordonez, Clawmaster.
Yes.
I mean, that guy was probably the king of the results. Mm-hmm. You know, he spent many years compiling results, and his form is still up.
Yeah, I was going to say, he made a lot more of them public than most people.
Yeah. It was definitely a heavy base for me starting. My archive was going through a lot of his stuff. And yeah, you'll see him. I've seen his name mentioned in these newsletters too. Yeah. So yeah, we can't forget to mention him.
Some of the other luminaries in the Eddie Gilbert fan club, Janie Engel, would she have been in wrestling yet at this point? Actually, in the business? Because I know she worked for Joe Blanchard as his, like, assistant before, like, moving up to eventually going to WCW and all that.
I don't know. I really don't know if she was in it or not, but she wasn't too long after that before she went to work with Joe.
Yeah. Dr. Jerry Graham of Los Angeles, California.
Another guy that Terry Justice spent time with, because he was from the same area.
Oh, okay.
He lived up there near Niagara Falls and that area.
Oh, I didn't realize. Wait, Dr. Jerry Graham. Wait, was he originally from there or he moved? Because I thought he spent most of his time on the West Coast at this point.
I think he was just living up there at the time.
Okay. Living in California, you mean?
Or no, Niagara Falls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Who else? Randy Hales, of course. Brian Hildebrand. Donnie Leibel. Best,
yeah.
Probably, I don't know what people would know him from these days, but I know him best from being the guy who would do the little news brief at the beginning of John Arezzi's radio shows. Pete Lederberg, photographer / photo owner / photo collection owner / briefly head of the replacement version of the Wrestling Fans International Association. So many different people. Like, some of these are people that newer fans wouldn't know, but. Like, you know, like Diane Devine or those type person. Or, of course, Jim Melby's here.
Yeah, Diane Devine, who she did her own little thing for her area, which was basically Central States. And McGuirk, when he would run shows in that area.
Yeah.
She was the main contributor to that stuff. And you mentioned WFIA. That's one thing you'll see a lot, because that's where all these people met up at. Was every year the WFIA would convene in some town, and all these people would hook up. And they would go to shows and go to the TV tapings. And they were doing that till how long?
There were different versions. Like, there were WFIA, and then there was Wrestling Fans International, and then there was... What was that last one? Was the last one the Joe Goodhart one? There were all sorts of different ones.
The main one was going into the 80s, because I remember they went to Memphis together, and they were all on television.
Well, eventually they realized, let's just go to Memphis every year, because they're the ones who, you know, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They're the ones who got along with all those guys the best and were the most welcoming and all that.
And what was funny about the WFIA was, you know, and you kind of understand it, but it was funny, most of all their awards went to the place they were at.
Well, every year.
Every
especially
year.
If there was an angle.
Yeah. In fact, the most famous angle involving WFIA is the Tommy Rich Eddie Gilbert angle.
With Pete Lederberg and Howard Baum.
Well, yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, if you've never seen that angle, you've got to watch it on YouTube. I'm sure it's on there, where Eddie Gilbert turns heel on Tommy Rich and the whole promo situation about that involving them being tag team of the year when they were only tag teaming at that time for maybe 3 months.
But you see, the voting was done in the spring.
Yeah, but and in that time, they were only tag team for like a month.
But they were so good.
I know. It was amazing. You know, you're so good after 1 month, you're tag team of the year.
They were actually a hell of a tag team, though.
Yeah. They had a great feud. Wickerson in the spoiler, which was Frank Morrell, not Don Jardine.
And with and the PYTs.
The PYTs. They had a good run.
Yes. And so, actually, what were... I totally lost track of what we were talking about that got us to. Oh, right. So it was the tag team of the year, right, with WFIA. And when I was doing that Eddie Gilbert article for Fighting Spirit, I was talking to Cornette, and he was like explaining to me how there was even kayfabe within the WFIA. Like, if a fan wasn't smartened up, you wouldn't ruin it for him.
Yeah, I mean,
so you kind of have
totally
to feel him out.
That. Yeah, totally.
No, I do too, but it's still kind of funny to think about.
Yeah, because, you know, you got to think about it. Back in the 70s and even into the 80s, there weren't a whole lot of smart marks, quote unquote, around.
No.
There really weren't.
And there still aren't now.
I have to explain stuff to people to this day. Well, you know, where I live, you know, I was like, you know, this is part of the story, right? And we're in 2015. But this is people that they're not online fans. They're just watch television. You know, so, yeah, even to this day, you have stuff to describe. You know, this is an angle, right? These guys really don't love, they really don't hate each other.
Oh, so we were going to talk about Terry Justice. What's the nicest way we can say that? Talk about Terry Justice.
Well, Terry Justice, I will say this. He had some really good bulletins.
Yes.
He basically dealt in clippings. He would get from random people around, and he would put them all together. And it's a wealth of information. A lot of things. I mean, it's unorganized as hell. But it's really good stuff, and it's from newspapers, and you get to see, you know, if you can go on Google News archives and see, you know, how newspapers treated wrestling back then. But he's got a, you know, stuff that's not on there, you know, and they treated wrestling. I wouldn't say they treated it completely as a real sport, but they would report on the results. A lot of the major newspapers would report the results,
mm-hmm.
you know, the shows in the area. So they treated it kind of like boxing in a way, I guess you could say, where they, you know. Like the Columbus newspaper, Columbus, Georgia, they would they have all the results, and you know they would post stuff about the show all week long. So you know you would get the cards and the results. Even the I think I don't know which New York paper that had stuff like that too. I mean, not as common, but they're not. I don't know if it's Times or one of them.
It was Daily News had results pretty regularly.
Daily News, yeah. And, you know, the Baltimore papers, Boston would do the Boston Garden results. So, you know, back in the day, you know, it was like a boxing type thing to report the wrestling results before everybody got smartened up. And he would have that. And he would get like these various columns from different newspapers or maybe even some of the local programs. Like AWA programs a lot of, which had all these stories and they were getting over all the angles. So you're understanding where all the angles were. And stuff like that. So, yeah, and they were big, big reports. They were well over 30 pages, too.
And he'd even have things from some of the magazines. Well, the magazines that circle of fans kind of dealt with, like the Norm Keitzer magazines, the Wrestling News series.
And he had numerous different things. Like, he had the TNT Times. He had TNT Power.
Right, TNT Power was the Gilbert fan club newsletter.
One Wrestling Nostalgia, which didn't go real long, which was mainly dealing in 60s and 70s and even like going to the 50s stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he had those. He had a lot of stuff going on. And we talked about he had Eddie Gilbert Fan Club. And mm-hmm. he had He was also a wrestling coach for high school in his area.
Yes. Like, if you look at the last issue of TNT Times, his brother put it together when Terry died in a – it was a car accident, right?
Yeah, he died in a car accident in 1981.
And it's a mix
– 82.
And it's like a mix of, like, his stuff from his favorite territories and some of the stuff about him when he passed and stuff like that.
Yeah, the guy was – yeah, he was a tremendous fan, but – he was overbearing in a relationship with Eddie Gilbert, you know, was going to that whole fan club thing.
Right. And we're only talking about this because really, if you ever talk to someone who was around then about Terry Justice and his newsletters, this always comes up.
He was obsessive and he would air all of his dirty laundry out in public, basically.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what it would. Well, because he would, if you read like some of the later issues, he'll have like a letter in there talking about it, about how, well, now Eddie Gilbert's not returning his calls and letters, or Eddie's mom took over the fan club, or all sorts of related issues.
At one point, he basically quit and came back. He quit doing them and came back. And then once he came back, he kind of like, that was the end of it with Eddie Gilbert deal. Yeah. But you know, you look at like 80, especially 1980, when there's a lot of stuff going on there where him and Eddie were, I mean, the drama that he had with Eddie, and he was just putting it all out there. I guess you could say it was shameless that, you know, he had all this out there so everybody could read it. And it's interesting to say the least. I mean, yeah. It's basically like, I guess you could say maybe in the early days of like a wrestling internet forum or something like that. Somebody, you know, is ranting about whatever and just putting it all out there. It's just something you just you didn't see.
Yes, it's like the original, I hate to use this as the comparison, like the Vince Russo Chris Cash split.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, you know, there's a flame war basically going on, but from one end in a lot of ways, you know, because you didn't get Eddie's side of the story. And then they had this problem. They got back together again, and so everything was good, you know. And then boom, there was the falling out after another falling out, and it was over after that.
And they were real friends, too. I mean, Eddie would, invite him over to his house in Tennessee, and
he would come in, wherever he was working at, he would go visit, and they would hang out. And he goes into all of his little travels, you know, sometimes in there, and he, like I said, that's where the Luke Dez stuff talks about. He talks about, you know, hanging out with Luke Dez, watching wrestling in his house, and I know Brian Hildebrand would they would hang out together. He talks about that. I mean, yeah. It was just a little, you know, the little subculture at the time. And, they were just friends. It was, and the thing about Eddie, you got to remember Eddie started out in that subculture.
Right. Of course.
He was a photographer, you know, he was part of that. So that's where, you know, Eddie knew all these people. That's the thing about Eddie, you know, and like Doug talked about on your podcast you did with him, how Eddie was always ahead of the game when it come to like wrestling newsletters and stuff. And being, you know, inside to the business, well, that's where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he had a different outlook on it than a guy who was, you know, a grizzled veteran in the 80s, you know, stuff like that, who thought that this, you know, they're killing the business, they're exposing it. I mean, he was part of the culture.
Yeah, I mean, and he
was like Cornette, yeah. Cornette and Heyman, same way.
Yep.
You look at why they were so close to Dave. They've known it forever. You know? That's what happens when you get performers in the business that grew up as contributors to newsletters. We've seen it today. You know, in recent years where, you know, people had done that. Whether different wrestlers, referees or whatever, they grew up part of that subculture, whether they were subscribers to the newsletter or whatever, and become sources.
Yeah. And then on the
you see a lot today in the major media. Bill Simmons is a great example. Bill Simmons is a Wrestling Observer subscriber, and he talks about it constantly on Grantland, you know, or before when he was on Page Two on ESPN, and a lot of people at ESPN were like that. Robert Flores, I know, I don't know if he was a subscriber or not, but huge wrestling fan. So now these people that grew up in that subculture now have some sort of power in media. And that's how, you know, stuff like WrestleMania comes around. That's how wrestling's been able to get more of a spotlight than it had gotten over the past years.
Yep. And then, I mean, we even had occasionally wrestlers who would do newsletters. There's probably none quite like the one that you found in these collections that I hadn't spotted yet, which was the Texas Roundup, which I'm fascinated by, which is an anonymous indie I don't know if I should necessarily say indie wrestler, because they were sort of territories in the area, but not exactly. But it was a short-lived 1990 newsletter by a Dallas area wrestler reviewing the various shows in the area, talking about what's going on, giving the payoffs if you had the information, etc. And he doesn't give his name. He prefers cash if you can send him cash, if you absolutely need to send a check. He has a non-wrestling business friend you can send it to, but he prefers cash. And it's pretty wild reading it.
Yeah, it's mainly set in 1990. There's some from 89 as well, and different ones in the folder.
Well, right, there's that other newsletter too, but with Texas Roundup, but, well, really that whole period, though, it's so interesting because you had, for a lot of that period, you had three different promotions in the area that had TV.
Yeah, you had USWA, which was in its dying at the time with Jerry Jarrett before he left and came back in 91. Then you had TWF.
Which was Gary Hart. At the, the Metroplex Arena, converted warehouse. And you had
NAWA.
The North American Wrestling Allegiance, which was Tim Brooks' promotion, which was also called Supersonic Texas Wrestling, at the world-famous Longhorn Ballroom.
Yeah, and some of these would go through different name changes in the time period.
Especially Tim Brooks.
Yeah, once Chris Adams got fired, you know, he started his little group called LYA.
Right, they didn't have TV.
They didn't have TV, but they did shows. So, and you had a lot of talent that was working different shows.
And more than one promotion. Yeah.
And more than one promotion. And like Big said, there's a whole lot of inside stories in there that are like, wow. You know, especially the stuff by Kevin Von Erich.
Well, I didn't see all of that yet. So what you tell one of these, because like I saw a little, like I, because I've been jumping around and kind of skimming them, like I saw the one covering the last last World Class show when he took over, saying that people were worried the building was about to be torn down, and like there was the one fan whose wife had passed away who had a plaque on her seat because she had been to every show for decades, and he took the plaque and everyone thought it was going to be the end of the building.
There was a World Class revival promotion at one point as well.
Well, when Kevin Von Erich got the injunction against Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah, and Kevin no-showed his own show. He came out to explain it, and him and Chris came out there, his brother, and they said you could just totally see the cocaine residue under their noses.
This is what, the week after or later in that show?
Later in the show, I think. And it was just a total embarrassment. I mean, you no-show your own show, your promoter. I mean, it's bad. And there's all kind of different stories in there about the stuff going on in the locker room and stuff like that. It is pretty interesting reading. And like I talked about detailed recap, there's a lot of detailed recaps on matches in those areas too. So it's just an interesting time in Texas wrestling because you remember how it used to be, the world class and all that structure. But this was in the middle of all this mass confusion in Texas where nobody knew what was going to happen. And there was uncertainty about the sportatorium. Actually still standing. It was interesting time.
So since we talked about Kevin Von Erich, this doesn't really have anything to do with anything, but I feel the need to bring up my absolute favorite Kevin Von Erich moment / quote. I think you know what this one is, right?
I think I know where you're going, but go ahead.
Okay, so he was in St. Louis, or going to be in St. Louis for some kind of indie booking, and this is 1992, and this was in the Observer at the time. As Dave put it, he made some quotes in a St. Louis paper last week that showed a state of mind or lack thereof. When asked what he'd been up to after arriving 2 hours late for an autograph session, Kevin replied that he was in Oklahoma and working with a group called Feed the Children. I feel I don't want to. I shouldn't do a Kevin Von Erich impression. I don't think so. I'll just. Oh man, it's a great. Oh man, it's a great group. I don't care if you hate my guts or whatever. They're fighting some disease that I told you I can't get political. But if we can't take care of the little kids, who will? The homosexuals. The homosexuals are in charge of the media. They'll run you down if you oppose them. The people I talk to are America. But if you don't dance their tunes, you don't get on television. It burns me up. Radical groups in San Francisco are telling you the whole country's like that. Well, it isn't. They all keep doing it and dying, and they call us ignorant. Now, you really got to see the quote and just hear it in Kevin Von Erich's voice in your head to really just get the full effect of it. Because he's going, like, from place to place and, like, bouncing from one thought to the other, almost as if there were something causing him to do that, that maybe he had done. And, of course, then he no-showed his scheduled appearance the next day in St. Louis, claiming there was a mechanical problem with his plane. The problem was everyone knew he was in town the day before. In reality, Kevin was waiting for Kerry at the airport, and Kerry arrived at 7 p.m. for a 2 p.m. show. And instead of going to the arena, Kevin just sat at the airport.
The Von Erichs, you know, they were in their own world, and, you know...
And by the way, I'm at the point where I really don't like to make fun of them, like, the whole Von Erich stories, blah, blah, blah thing anymore, but, yeah. Like, but this is different. This is a little different. This specific story.
Well, some stuff, you know, yeah, it's pretty funny. You know, definitely the deaths and all that stuff. Yeah, that's not a funny subject.
No, but I mean, and, like, the loaded Kerry stories and that type of thing. Yeah, but this is a little, a little of a different thing. Even if I'm sure there may have been some kind of personal problems involved in whatever.
Thankfully, okay. Kevin's got straightened out. You know, if anyone saw that, you know, ESPN short, 30 for 30 short about the Von Erichs. I mean, Kevin's in a good place right now, which is good because, you know, I mean, there's been so much crap that's gone on with that family over the years, and it's terrible.
Yeah, and that's one of those things in these old newsletters that just kind of, all this Von Erich stuff keeps coming up, just kind of regardless of which newsletter.
There was some story about them, man, you know, whether, you know, it was the stuff in Japan and the cat, and I mean, it was just, there's so many stories about what they did when they were loaded.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that can't be avoided. It is what it is.
Yeah. And some of these newsletters, like, one that I had always kind of wanted to see and never did until Jason put these up was Combat Sports, which I believe it's by publisher Michael O'Hara. And I believe it was published by the same people, or he's the guy who did New Wave Wrestling Magazine, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
New Wave Wrestling was, what would be the best way to describe them? Because they were kind of their own thing. They were a little different style-wise from the other magazine. I'm trying to think what's the best way to, like, because they didn't really have outside ads. I think their ads were mostly like for like their own gimmicks and stuff that they sold.
Yeah, and it was started in the late 80s.
Yeah, I think so. Kind of so, and then they also kept doing the Combat Sports newsletter, which, in case you're wondering what Combat Sports would have been back then, it's mostly wrestling with a little bit of roller derby and occasionally traditional martial arts.
Yeah.
So it's got kind of a weird, eclectic mix of stuff, but lots of clippings, especially like newspaper articles and stuff like that. And it's pretty interesting to read through. There's one, I don't think I saved it separately, I'd have to check, where Michael O'Hara has a like exchange of letters, I think, with the WWF over that he had been in charge of the official Hulk Hogan fan club. Like when Hogan first came to the WWF in 1979, 1980, and he was trying to assert that he, based on Hogan's promise that he could run it, still had the rights to run the fan club. So he printed the letter from WWF in his response.
So when would he have started this club? When he was in Georgia, or
I think when he would have first come to WWF, because I think. Okay.
So it was a Hulk Hogan fan club. It wasn't Terry the Hulk Boulder or Sterling Golden.
No, it was Hulk Hogan.
Okay.
So I'll have to find that. But because he was from New York. I mean, he's from New York City.
And one thing about Hogan in that era, if you watch that television, which I have a ton of that old television, and Hogan was over very early. The fans were into him. Because he just had this different look. I mean, he wasn't what you would, you know, see from Hogan later on, because Freddie Blassie did a lot of the talking. But Hogan definitely had it even back then. You know, he had his own fans, especially like you go into Philly and stuff like that. They would definitely cheer him on.
Yeah.
So I can definitely see a fan club growing for Hogan.
Yeah, and I guess you can't talk about this stuff without talking about Georgie Ann Acropolis.
Yeah, Georgie Ann, you know, her newsletter was different, I guess you could say.
I mean, and that's, I'm not saying it in a bad way, but it's the type of thing that doesn't necessarily hold up as an interesting read now, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it was a lot of, I guess she had some clippings, some fan writing, lots of stuff like birthdays. It was always a good-natured thing. And again, nothing wrong with that, but it kind of, if you're kind of just looking for stuff the way we are, it doesn't hold up. I mean, back then, like, it was, I got a couple issues. What?
There's no meat to it, right?
Not basically. Necessarily. But I mean, because she was going for something specific, though.
Yeah. And a lot of people were friends with her. I mean, she was, you got to remember, she was an early part of OneWrestling.com.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she had a presence online or in the early days of the Wrestling Online deal. And yeah, I mean, it was what it was. I mean, I got to describe it. Maybe it's like a Us Weekly for Wrestling or something like that. In a lot of ways.
Something like a mix between that and some of the older fan bulletins.
Yeah, it was definitely its own deal. And she was tight with Bruno, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, she had the Bruno connection, and she was able to get stuff that other people didn't get, as far as like information, but nothing of really substance, I guess you could say.
Right, because she was always very pro the business, so to speak.
Yeah, she protected the business. Very well. She was not one of these that was going out trying to put all the dirt out there. This definitely wasn't a dirt sheet. No. That's the truth.
No. But I mean, there's some, I think if we had more of them, I think we'd be able to give a better idea of it because of the ones that are there, and it kind of skips around to the ones that Jason has up. Like, or from, there's like a couple of older ones and then it jumps to a couple in the mid-90s, and then like most of the ones he has, I think, are more internet era. So I'd like to see more of the ones from earlier on. I'm guessing those might be a little more substantive.
And the name of it was Wrestling Chatterbox.
Yeah. Yes, we should have said that. Wrestling Chatterbox.
So yeah, I mean, the Chatterbox title pretty much was a good title for her.
Right. And she also had her own fan clubs, I think, because she had been around forever. I mean, what was her maiden name that she wrote for magazines under and stuff?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
I feel like I should know this. When did she pass away? Because it'll be in the Observer bio Dave did.
A few years ago. I can't remember exactly when.
I am trying to remember.
It wasn't real long ago, though.
No, it wasn't. I'm just trying to, I can't remember what the, but yeah, she had written for a lot of the newsstand magazines and for other bulletins and stuff for a long time. And she was kind of like around when I started reading the newsletters regularly, she was kind of with the, I mean, she, I guess you could almost say she was kind of the person that, because she was friends with everyone, like, was keyed in the most with kind of both sides, so to speak, of the newsletter world. Like, you had your, like, when I came in, like, in the mid-90s is when I started subscribing to different newsletters regularly. It was like you had your Torch Observer type side, and maybe Perspective, Wrestling Perspective would be over there, too. And then you also had stuff like Wrestling Then and Now, Evan Ginsberg's, Mike Lano's Wrestling Reality, and maybe one or two others that I'm forgetting. Like, I guess maybe also Whatever Happened To and that type of thing. Like, kind of the nostalgia ones and kind of who they were friends with. And
you mentioned Evan Ginsberg. Evan Ginsberg still does stuff now. Right. I'm also friends with him on Facebook. And he does different type of shows on YouTube and stuff like that. So he's still doing a lot of stuff involving wrestling.
He's always got all sorts of different irons in the fire.
Yeah.
And his was one of the ones that I subscribed to regularly because it was just, I was always into that type of thing, like old clippings and stuff going back to when we had this great used bookstore here in Long Beach that one day, like, they I don't know if they bought a bunch of old wrestling magazines, and they, but they had them cheap or whatever, and that got me into that sort of thing. So I remember, and it was an inexpensive newsletter too, so I subscribed, and it was fun. And eventually it got kind of, like, did you ever read it?
I've seen some, yeah. I was never a subscriber or anything, but yeah, I've seen some of them.
There were a few things. It went downhill. It kind of changed direction when he brought on, like, this editor guy to make it look prettier.
Yeah.
Jeff Archer was the guy's name. Like, there was, and he put out a book, which actually is probably, because you can get it cheap, and I should probably get a copy since I don't have it anymore, called Theater in a Squared Circle, that reprinted a lot of the good, better Wrestling Than a Now stuff. That if you can get it on Amazon, I think you get it for like $4 or something, is worth getting. But, and there, it also, he had a feature called Dirt Sheet for a time, which talked about the various wrestling newsletter drama. Which, again, if being that who, which side he was on could prove to be interesting.
Yeah.
Especially given the feelings between Dave's and, well, the Observer side and the Torch side.
Yeah, that's the main one of the modern era. Compared
to Mike Lano at the time. Although now everyone seems to get along, more or less.
Yeah.
Which is good. At least, I mean, in those circles, there are a few people that don't get along with everyone else, but it's the type that don't get along with a lot of people. So,
yeah. One thing that we forgot to mention, and I'm just not thought about it, mentioning Dave and Wade, was when promotions would use their names for jobbers. Like Herb Abrams.
Davey the Observer Meltzer.
Yeah, and Jim Cornette.
Well, he did it, but he did that more. Well, actually, was this before he had heat with Wade?
This would have been in Smoky Mountain 1994.
Was it before this? So I don't remember exactly how the whole thing went with him and Wade, but he was friends with Dave the whole time.
Yeah, it was a cutesy thing, you know.
Right, it was
with Cornette. Herb Abrams, was totally spiteful.
Well, yeah, it was the Rock and Roll Express were gonna have a match against Wade Keller and Dave Meltzer.
Yes.
But before they could come out, the Rock and Roll Express took their place.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. And by the way,
you mean the Heavenly Bodies were supposed to take on?
What did I say? The Rock and Roll Express were going to take them on, and the Rock and Roll Express took their place against the Rock and Roll Express.
Yeah,
that's what I said. Okay. Yes, the Heavenly Bodies. And by the way, the Theater in a Squared Circle. There are a ton of copies on Amazon.
Oh, that's cool.
Used copies. And at the time, it was disappointing because I had read so much of that stuff on Wrestling Then and Now. But now, to get it for $4 and to have some of that stuff, it's probably a pretty good buy.
Yeah, it is, you know, and, you know, we talked about eBay earlier. If you can catch it, and sometimes you can, I've bought a lot of old wrestling magazines off eBay, like on bulk buys and stuff, because if you try to buy a single issue of a magazine, you're going to pay, on the low end, probably close to like $4 or $5, which isn't, you know, isn't
bad. That's like low-end convention price, and even then it's fine. Yeah. Like, eBay seems to be, like, above, convention prices.
But eBay, you can find, you know, all kinds of old wrestling magazines. You can find a lot of the old programs. I mean, I don't know if it's as much as it used to be, but you'll find old wrestling programs, you'll find old wrestling newsletters, all kinds of different stuff on there of this subculture.
Well, I was just talking to you a few days ago about that Joey Styles newsletter is on.
Yeah, Joey Styles, who, you know, his newsletter was around when he was doing ECW.
He did ads for it on TV briefly. Yeah. I mean, this thing was not, I don't think it was around long. So what was it? What did I say? It was World Wrestling Weekly.
Yeah. And then this is right before onewrestling.com.
Yes. Cause Joe, how long did he keep, did that stay kayfabed?
I don't know if it went a year, but it went a little while.
And even then it was kept, even then it was kept pretty quiet though for a while.
Because the public face was Bob and Dave. Shear.
Yes.
Bob Ryder and Dave Shear were like the public face of it, and then it come find out that Joey Styles is the one in charge of it.
Right. Yes. And actually, when did he bow out?
When he signed with WWE.
Yes. Okay. So did he sell his half to Bob?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess let's talk about this for a second. Like, people don't realize onewrestling.com was like the site for several years.
Because Dave had no internet presence at that time.
And neither did Wade.
And onewrestling.com was where you – I mean, it was the main thing. There were a ton of different sites around that would put the news out there.
By far the best was Mikasa Wrestling, which became a part of WrestleManiacs, and that which then became part of CBS Sportsline's Wrestle Line, because Mikasa was Mike Samuda, who was in law school at the time, ended up becoming a disgraced lawyer through part of what was it, real estate deals or something?
Yeah.
And he was basically the one guy who would call the Torchin Observer hotlines, read the Observer, report everything correctly, give credit for everything. He was literally the only guy who was doing that. So, like, for example, I think one of the first internet interviews with Dave Meltzer was with him, and he had a lot of respect for Mike because Mike was the only guy who was doing that type of thing right.
Yeah, because you had, you know, Lords of Pain and Al Isaacs. We can't forget him. You know, Al Isaacs was a guy, you know, you would see signs for him on Nitro and Raw.
Right, well, his site was Scoops Central.
Yeah, Scoops. Yeah. So if you ever see, if you watch those old shows.
Well, those are on the network now, or at least, I guess that's a little after his peak, but not exactly. But
yeah, you'll see, you know, Scoops with the Z instead of the S. That's what that's talking about. And then, you know, what, 411 and all, I mean, all this different stuff.
I don't think 411 was around then, but the big.
It started. It was around.
How did Scoops become a thing, though? Because he was just like this random stand-up comedian guy.
It's basically how WrestleZone has become a thing these days. You know, I talk about the people that.
But WrestleZone has a corporate parent, at least now it does. I mean, it's owned by Crave.
Yeah, but, you know, people would go there. And so I saw this on. I saw people, you know, at my job or whatever, that wrestling fans. I saw on WrestleZone, blah, 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 blah. I was like, why do you go there? Let me show you. Figure4online.com, you know, let me show you where you get the stuff direct, you know, not the stuff, you know, or Pro Wrestling Insider.
And WrestleZone has broken news.
Yeah, it has broken news. I'll give them credit. They've gotten more into it, but in the early days, I saw this on WrestleZone. So they're just ripping off this stuff, really, and just go to directly to the content providers. But yeah, I mean, that's basically what it was back then. There was just a whole lot of people that was ripping off the information because, like you said, Dave and Wade didn't have an internet presence yet.
Well, I'm trying to remember with One Wrestling, though. I mean, I guess they were reporting their own stuff. I don't remember.
Yeah, Bob and Shearer, because they were deep in ECW and the connections.
Yep.
And and of course, Bob would go to WCW. So he had that whole deal not too long after that. So, yeah, I mean, they knew a lot of stuff. And they had people working for them that knew stuff. So... yeah, it was definitely the first of the major wrestling news sites. And then Dave would hook up with Brian in, what, 99? Or going to 2000?
Well, no. The original Observer site was, I think, was Live Audio Wrestling involved the whole time or not till later?
Well, it was liveaudiowrestling.com/WO.
Right. But I think that was a little, I don't remember the whole chain of events.
But the IATA show started in 99.
Right. So and that was that was the real beginning, because I think it was Dave having the platform that he brought the newsletter online.
Yes.
Briefly. Although the newsletter didn't stay online long.
No.
He had the web presence, but he didn't have the newsletter online long.
Yeah.
Because it was less than a print subscription, but probably not inexpensive enough to get motivate people to pay.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Whereas now, you know, it's part of the, you know, $11 a month, et cetera, and you get all the audio. And, right, because that audio changed everything because, whatchamacallit, because now you can add so much more content for people's, you know, money, whether it's PW Insider or Torch or Observer. And I like the way Torch is doing it. Because Wade has the old John Arezzi radio shows, Pro Wrestling Spotlight, that I used to listen to growing up here in New York, which, it to me, that's a great value add.
And that's another thing we need to get into as well. You know, we'll get to a second, but let's be honest here. The beginning of all this stuff was RSPW.
Rec.sport.prowrestling, the pro wrestling. So, man, people today aren't even going to, unless they're like very sophisticated into their internet downloading practices, no one's going to know what Usenet is. So,
yeah, and back in the day when Google first started, they had the archives.
Well, they bought it from Deja News. Deja.com, Deja News was the main site for if you wanted to post and read news groups without doing anything too complicated. Or, I mean, AOL had their way, but it was kind of crappy. And Deja News, they had an archive, and then Google bought them and some other archives. So that's like, if you, but you know what, though? Those Google News archives were not well maintained, because now everything's kind of not threaded well or anything.
At the start, though, before they started changing all their stuff, it was easier to go through.
When they first launched the archive, it was amazing, because they had stuff going back on and off on Usenet back to, like, 1981.
Yeah, and you see people like Shearer and Pete Stein from Death Valley Driver doing the Lucha TV reports from 1991. You know, this is – and internet got big in 94, 95.
And so, then AOL added Usenet in 96.
Yeah.
It was – what was it called? September 96? And it was called – people called it the summer – the September that never ends.
Yeah.
Because so, all of it is then there would be people coming onto news groups that didn't know about etiquette or anything. And suddenly it was not the – you had a very relative to the internet – really, since post-AOL, very high level of discussion, because it was mostly people at college and that type of thing, or people who were super into computers, and, you know, and so they
It was guys like that, you know, like Pete was, I think, in Bradley at the time, going to college, and he was posting that stuff. You had guys like
Phil Schneider, was it?
Schneider, Gene Rice.
American.
That's basically where Death Valley Driver was born, was off of RSPW. You had Skyhawks, John D. Williams, Frank Jewett, all of them were on there when they formed the arena.com, which was another, in this time period, a great website, for the time. Because it talked a lot of different stuff that you didn't see anywhere else. You know, there are a lot of stuff about Japan, especially older all Japan and stuff like that.
And the Japanese magazine photos that all sorts of websites stole while badly trying to crop out the TOA logo that Frank put on them.
Yeah, and you know they had the TOA booking game and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff in that era that was on that site. And you know, all these guys came from RSPW, CRZ.
Well, and there was also Prodigy, though, which I don't think.
And Prodigy was Bob Ryder, and all that stuff was prevalent on there. You know,
a lot of the your ECW fan contingent was on Prodigy.
Yeah, CyberSlam '96. If you remember, the build up to that show was like talking about the stuff about Prodigy.
And I think they had it wasn't called CyberSlam, but they had their first internet convention, was the year before, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, but CyberSlam, I said, was the first time that word was used, the cyberspace.
Right.
So, yeah, ECW was the first promotion to fully embrace the internet. And that's why they had the fan base they did, mainly. You know, it was a lot of internet fans.
Right.
That's who they were appealing to.
Right. And we didn't really talk about tape trading, which... Tape trading, a lot of people don't realize, led directly to the birth of the Observer.
Yes. Dave was trading tapes with all kinds of people from around the country. And you would see these in the newsletter, too, where they were, asking for tapes.
Right.
Anybody have tapes from such territory? I got tapes from this territory. And that's how that scene got going.
Well, that's what tape trading was at first, because even if you didn't have two VCRs, if you had one, you'd tape your promotion and trade it with someone else.
Yeah.
In another territory. And
reading it made me so jealous. I wish I was around back then, man. I get all this stuff direct, and first generation.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. There's no telling what some of these people have gotten that we don't know. These people that's like falling off the face of the earth. What kind of collections they have? Because we know what a lot of Dave's stuff has got through different lists.
Well, not a lot. Well, I think he has a lot of stuff that we don't know about.
Yeah. That's the ultimate gold mine, I think, is Dave's video collection. But Steve Minari and stuff like that. Those guys.
Well, he sold his collection, though.
I know, but I mean, they were the main guys back in the day.
Well, yeah, and Dave. So Dave was trading with all these different people, and he was writing letters about what was happening in each territory, what was good on each tape, whatever. Each time he wrote a letter to someone, and then he realized, wait a second, I'm writing the same letter to all these people.
Yeah.
So it started as just something he was sending to people that he was trading with, and then it became more, and then it kind of evolved over and over over the years until it became what we have now. I mean, as some people have learned, you know, if they've look at some of the early issues, it was more of a fan thing earlier, and it kind of evolved slowly, probably first started evolving maybe around like 87 into a little more of a serious thing, and then by 90, 91, when he got the job with the National, which we'll talk about in a second, is when it became the more serious, straight news kind of thing that
it was fun. That's one thing, you know, and Dave's Dave. I mean, he still does great stuff, but you look at those old newsletters from that era, and it's a way more fun because Dave is, he's highly opinionated.
Yes.
And, you know, he likes who he likes, and he doesn't like who he doesn't like, and he doesn't hide it. And it's a totally different perspective than what he has now. I mean, he still shows some of that now, but he's like, I guess you could say, the Walter Cronkite of wrestling right now is like the main guy. But back then,
you're from Atlanta. How are you calling anyone but Gordon the Walter Cronkite of wrestling?
Well, I'm talking about like porting.
He was the one they always called the Walter Cronkite of wrestling.
Yeah, but Dave was, that era, yeah, he definitely, you know, had news and stuff, but it was definitely a different style of newsletter.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, the editors, especially, you know, I mean, the letters to the editor, where you see, you know, people from that would become in the business, or, you know, people from this tape trading subgenre, like John McAdam or Jeff Baldwin and stuff like that. I mean, this really good stuff. Like I say, it's totally different than what it is now.
Yeah. And I even lost my train of thought, actually, because
we're talking about
the National, though. With
the National. Yeah, Dave went to work with the National, which was Frank DeFord left Sports Illustrated and formed his own newspaper, I guess you could say. Or magazine. It was on paper. It's called like a USA Today type thing.
But it was a national newspaper, but it also had a local section, but it was all sports. And yeah. they used satellites to send it across the country to do the different versions and the printing and all that. And it was owned by how do you pronounce the last name? The family that owned the supermarkets or whatever? Or Televisa or what was it?
Oh, Jesus.
Alas Caraga?
But Frank DeFord was the guy in charge.
No, I know, but I was trying to remember the name of the...
The owners. I cannot remember.
You know who I'm talking about, though, right?
I know you're talking about, yeah. And to give you, I mean, for those of you that follow ESPN, you know, Chris Mortensen, who's the main NFL guy on there, that's where he was working at before he went to ESPN, he was the NFL guy at the National. So, I mean, they had a lot of big names there. And it lasted for about 2 years, and then it fell apart.
But Dave was the wrestling guy. And yeah. It was... What was the column called originally? Grunt and Grin?
Yeah.
Because they wanted him to do a wrestling humor column, and then it was like the first or second week was when Sting blew out his knee.
Yeah.
So it changed pretty quickly, because he couldn't really figure out a way to do a humor column for... Yeah, because it's so weird to think back that Sting... It wasn't even an ACL tear or anything. He tore his patella tendon, and everyone was already... His career was over.
He tore it while Wahoo McDaniels pulled him off the cage.
Yeah.
You know, the angle was always sold as the horseman injured his knee. Now, go back and watch the Clash, and you can see when Wahoo yanked him off the cage, he landed wrong.
Yep.
And he's still limping immediately. Yeah, they still tried to do the angle, though, and he was limping so horribly that they had to call the audible and get him out of there.
Yeah.
And it totally changed that promotion after that.
Yes. And
because he was supposed to work Flair and Paul Brawl, beat him for the title, and then boom. Not Paul Brawl, but Wrestle War? Yeah, Wrestle War.
Right.
And he would get the title later on, but Sting was never the same Sting again.
And I'm sure we'll have an episode of Excellent on Bad Street about this within the next few months.
Yeah, I'm sure we will too.
And so the National led to the Observer becoming popular enough that it finally became a, you know, full-time living wage for Dave.
And it got Dave connections.
Yes.
That was probably the most important thing. Dave got connected in the media then with different people.
Well, wasn't so, it? Well, even before that, I mean, just because some of his subscribers were like, he had a little bit of connections, but he got more connected. Because wasn't it Dick Ebersol that made the suggestion to Frank DeFord?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Dave had a pretty good relationship with Vince McMahon. So at one point, in different points over the years.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's pretty sure. I'm sure Vince and Ebersol talked about it. So yeah, I mean, Dave had a presence.
And with the tape trading, I mean, when, because, I mean, you, I don't know, were you online that much before me as much as you, or just, I guess you were into the newsletters and tape trading before me, because, like, I didn't get
heavily into the, into being online until, like, 96.
Right, so I got online in 97, and I got pretty heavily into it quickly.
Yeah, and see, I didn't have my, I had to go to the library, look at the library. me and my brother both would go to the library and go in, and that's how I first bought tapes was through I was looking for because I want to see old Georgia wrestling tapes because it's something I just never saw, you know, remember. Right. And I remember typing in something in – I cannot even remember what the search – I may have been Alta Vista, you know, because Yahoo was – just getting going.
Well, Yahoo was a directory. It was not a search engine for years.
Yeah, there was some search. I want to say Alta Vista. It may have been, oh, God. I cannot remember. Lycos or something like that. One of those early search engines. And I remember typing in, and I didn't say Tommy Rich wrestling tapes. And the first result that came up was John McAdams' website. And I went there and I was like, oh my God, you know, look at all this, look at all these wrestling tapes. And I started buying the first wrestling tapes I bought online was from him. And this was around 97, 98. Yeah. So, 97.
Right.
And he had all these great tapes. And, you know, you got to think back in this time period, the video quality was, pretty shaky.
Getting older stuff, especially,
yeah, but and the prices were way different. You know, one tape back then cost like $18 for one tape, whether it was a 2-hour tape or a 6-hour tape, the price was the same. So, I just started buying tapes, and you get like 10 tapes for like $150 or something like that, $160, and I would buy 10 tapes like every so often, and that's how I got into it. And, later on, I first, hooked up with Death Valley Driver a couple years. Well, I started reading Death Valley Driver in the early days. I really didn't get involved until like 2000.
Right. Yeah.
And then that's where you were on there. And we hooked up through the chat room and stuff like that. So, that's how I've known you was from then.
Yes.
So, it's
man, that was 15 that years long. Ago. I feel old.
It's hard to when you feel old. it's hard to believe it's been so long, it's 20 years into the internet being big, basically.
Yeah, and with me with tapes, for me it started out of the radio shows here in New York because, I mean, I was getting the Torch, but that was. At first, that was the only newsletter I was getting regularly. Like, I had gotten some other newsletters, like, as, like, free issues a few years before. And but Rob Feinstein started buying ads on John Arezzi's radio show, which, by the way, I believe are edited out of the versions that are on the Torch website, even though the other ads are kept on. And I think I bought an ECW TV tape from him and some other stuff. And eventually I found out about other people. But first, then when Get in the Ring was on here in New York, which was a later radio show, they had ads at first from Dave's Wrestling Emporium.
Yes. And the thing about Feinstein was, and you gotta remember, the first time I saw him was, he was a character basically on ECW television.
Yes. He was, it was as Rob Feinstein first.
Yeah. 911 chokeslammed him. And, but before that, he was shilling his tapes in the Aftermax.
It was starting like early 95. He was taking out full page. It was always for like stuff like the EC. It was always like ECW specific ads, though.
Not always. Well, he had Smoky Mountain stuff in there too.
Well, the stuff that he had negotiated deals for.
Yes. So that's where I first saw, knew of RF videos from there, and I was like, always like, now I want to get videos from this guy, but I don't want to pay like whatever the money was. And later on, I did, but 16-year-old me was totally different than 18-year-old me.
Right.
He was around back then, and you talk about radio shows in Atlanta.
Wrestling radio with Jim Ross.
Jim Ross had radio every Sunday night on 750 AM, which was the big station in Atlanta on the AM dial. I mean, at nighttime, 750 would go way out. It's a super radio station. I mean, their signal's huge. And Jim Ross was on there, and it started like 91. And every week he would have somebody on, or, he would do the show by himself and take calls and stuff like that. But that was the first, like, wrestling show other than watching television that I was into. And it would walk that line at times of going – I mean, sometimes he would go over the line as far as going into full shoot mode. And a lot of – they would talk about WWF and talk about things that was going on outside WCW and stuff like that. When it comes to WCW, they tried to stay within the boundaries in a lot of ways. But whenever you would have a guest on that, say somebody like Michael Hayes, they would like shoot the breeze about Mid-South and old stuff. It was always cool to listen to. I used to record them on audio tape, and I wish I still had that stuff. Mm-hmm. I recorded over them. But Jim Ross had that show. And then Mike Tenay had his show that was syndicated.
Wrestling Insiders.
And I remember hearing it on, One-on-One Sports Network, I think it was.
Oh, I was talking to someone about this recently. I can't remember the name.
It was the first sports radio network that was syndicated. And I think it was One-on-One. Because I think Jay Mariotti and, there's another guy on there. Some guys are prevalent sports writers had shows on there, and Mike Tenay had his show on there, and I would listen to it.
Well, so, and John Arezzi took over Wrestling Insiders for a little while too.
Yeah, John Arezzi had his show, like you talking about in New York. So
no, but I think he took over Tenay's show for a little while.
Yeah, he did. So yeah, in the '90s, he had all the newsletters getting online.
Well, and
the
in Philly, you had Joel Goodhart, and that
Joel
was,
Goodhart.
Although that was more of an ad for his stuff, wasn't it?
Basically, it was a promotional tool,
right? Because he had his bus trips, he had his Tri-State Wrestling Alliance shows, he had his lunches with. Did you see that the Gary Hart Great Muda one showed up online? Their Q&A.
Yeah, I haven't watched it.
Okay,
but Goodhart, I mean, those TWA shows were always a blast because he had all these like different matchups and wild stuff going on. Of course, the legendary one is the whole Eddie Gilbert Cactus Jack thing. Right. But that was basically the precursor to Eastern Championship Wrestling.
See,
was a precursor to Extreme Championship Wrestling.
See, I would argue that in a way, it's actually more of a precursor to Ring of Honor, just with a very different indie scene.
Maybe. I mean, I know they were going. His buddy Dell and the Buddy Rogers died.
Yeah. Have you seen ever seen the lineup for the last show they were advertising?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay, it's on Jason's site, so talk for a minute while I go look out.
Buddy, I remember reading this in the Aftermags. They were pushing it heavily that, Buddy Rogers and Buddy Landell was going to have Battle of the Ancient Boys Part 2 because, Buddy Rogers and Ric Flair had the first one in Crockett in 79 when they went around the loop doing that feud. And, they had pictures of Rogers, he'd been working out. He was in great shape for a guy his age.
Oh, yeah. There was that one picture that was always in the magazines, too.
Yeah, and then he died of a heart attack. And the match never happened.
No, actually, no. It was before he died. The show just got canceled.
That's it. Yeah, the show got canceled. That's right.
But the match, no one ever tried picking up the match. Okay, so this was January 25th, 92 in Philly was when this was scheduled for.
That's the show, right?
Okay, yeah. The announced matches were Buddy Rogers versus Buddy Landell in the battle to determine the true Nature Boy, wink, wink. Steve Williams and Terry Gordy against Dan Crawford and Doug Furness.
All Japan special.
Yeah, but they had never faced each other in All Japan, at least on TV.
And never here either.
I don't think, but did they ever have any matches against each other, even on house shows?
I think they did work each other.
Okay. Eddie Gilbert versus Kevin Sullivan, Falls Count Anywhere match. Both guys had been working for the promotion regularly. And Chris Benoit against Shiro Koshinaka. So you have a New Japan match and an All Japan match. I'm a little skeptical about this one.
Well, the Good Heart shows were, I mean, they're just always wild. You know, with the Lawler and Terry Funk. Was it Lawler and Stan Hansen?
No, are you thinking of the Terry Funk and Stan Hansen match?
Terry Funk.
But that was a Corluzzo show. But they were those promotions commingled for a while.
And that's another guy, Dennis Corluzzo, who had his presence around back then too. He was in these newsletters as well. You see his name pop up a lot.
And of course Vince Russo,
yes,
who got in through a Rise's radio show because he had his video store first and sponsored it and then got involved in the radio show and financing it. And then they had their split and all this stuff happened. And actually, I talked about this in Fighting Spirit magazine in my Russo article last summer, so go read that. But one of the things Russo wanted to do when he became partners with John Arezzi in the show, which by the way, literally lasted 90 days, was to start a Pro Wrestling Spotlight weekly newsletter. And I have partial scans of some of these, including a Vince Russo editorial on the WWE sex scandals, which I have right in front of me. Now, I will try to emphasize when he has all caps and bold and stuff, but his writing style has literally not changed in 23 years.
I can believe that. You see him on Twitter. It's the same guy.
Yes. So we've got Knowing When to Say No, an editorial by Vince Russo. The WWF has been turned upside down this week by child sex abuse and homosexual allegations. At this point, it is important for us all to remember one thing. Ken Patera said it best. People don't give a shit what people do in their personal lives. We have two separate issues on our hands here. The first is alleged child sex abuse. This is a crime. The law, all caps, will handle this. The second issue concerns alleged homosexuality in the WWF. I have heard names mentioned this week regarding homosexuality inside the WWF, and I can only shake my head. However, I do not care what people do in their personal lives. What I am concerned about is just one issue. All caps and bold, does homosexuality have a bearing on the WWF? Is this why we see grown men sporting dresses? Does one's sexuality have a final say on the decision dictation of one's career? Unfortunately, I don't have answers to these questions, and I probably never will. Okay? However, what I do know is this. If you are employed by a company that lets, L-E-T apostrophe S, your sexuality decide your future, then you had better get your head examined. Nobody can all caps make you wear a dress. Nobody can all caps make you change your sexual tendencies. And nobody can run your life. You could pay this reporter all the money in the world if any organization let my sexuality decide my future. I'm going to start reading the sentence again to see if I get the syntax right. You could pay this reporter all the money in the world, comma, if any organization let my sexuality decide my future, I would simply say, M-dash, all caps, screw you, exclamation point. It's called dignity, fellas, knowing when to get out, making somebody do something that they don't want to do. Remember the late adorable Adrian Adonis? Do I think that homosexuality has some bearing on a wrestler's future in the WWF? Yes, I do. But this is just my opinion. However, all caps, no. These allegations won't hurt the WWF. No. People won't stop watching. And he's using M-dashes and commas interchangeably. No, and yes, people don't care what people do in their personal lives. Money can only talk to a certain point. I only hope the heroes of my children have the dignity and the pride to do what they believe in. Now, for what is this is actually a surprisingly nuanced take on homosexuality from 1992 Vince Russo.
Yeah.
All things considered. But it's like, what was it that I'm... I'm not sure I ever will know. Oh, wait. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer to these questions, and I probably never will. And then he also did some fantasy booking.
Oh, no, that's not a surprise.
So he fantasy booked WrestleMania 8 before there was an actual card. So it got, let's book WrestleMania 8 by Vince Russo. Step aside, Junior. I, Vincent James Russo, am booking WrestleMania 8. I don't know. I'm not going to read this whole thing verbatim. Maybe I don't know if I should. oh, he thinks that IRS and Ted DiBiase shouldn't face the Legion of Doom. He thinks that they have to, that, oh, his fantasy booking is for Legion of Doom to turn heel, pay this, and pay the Steiners to get them into the WWF immediately.
They went too far off.
He's still about a year off.
Yeah, a little bit less. But
and
yeah.
Then for the Intercontinental title, he thinks Roddy Piper should defend it against Hulk Hogan. Oh, here, this is the best part. That's right, it's time to I'm going to do the terrible fake Vince Russo voice. That's right, it's time to turn Hogan. What the hell did that have become British? I'm not going to do the fake Vince Russo voice. Yeah, this just shows how few people I'm around in my part of Long Island that don't have any kind of New York accent. The Hulkster has been on top of WWF for almost 10 years. We are tired of him, and so are all the little Hulkamaniacs. His reign is finished. No more prayers, no more vitamins. The only way to pump life back into him is to turn him heel and rename him Sterling Golden. To hell with the merchandise. It's time to shake up the WWF! Exclamation point. Can you imagine this match? Question mark. He also wants Ric Flair with a K to face The Undertaker.
Well, that was kind of built. I mean, there was an angle there for that.
A little. Other main event, Sid Justice versus Surprise Challenger, who he would say would be Ultimate Warrior. So he actually gets a little close on some things.
The thing, and the Piper Hogan thing is that the match that they should have ran at Mania 1 year and never did.
As a babyface match, though?
Period.
Yeah.
I mean, the tag match, yeah, but real, a Hogan Piper singles match would have been pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
Like WrestleMania 2 would have been a great one to do that, even though you had Piper and Mr. T. But yeah, I mean, that should have happened. And he's totally right with Hogan on 92. If you remember, I mean, Hogan was, I mean, the negative reaction was coming. And yeah, I mean, the signs were there. So he was on to something, but it is.
Hello? So. Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's just Vince Russo, though. 1992 Vince Russo is almost exactly the same as 2015 Vince Russo.
Except for the Jesus stuff, but who knows?
Well, he really doesn't even talk about that stuff on Twitter.
He used to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Did Ring of Glory ever make it to tape, by the way?
I don't think it did.
Yeah. There were a lot of Jesus promotions during that period, weren't there? When he was trying to run Ring of Glory?
But there's a lot of...
There were smaller shows, but there were a lot of bigger ones. Like, wasn't there the one that was on Trinity Broadcasting Network that had, like, the one special show with... Like, that had, like, the all-star lineup of evangelical wrestlers?
Yeah. And then you had, you know, the ones where Greg Valentine... And it will work, and Buff Bagwell, you know, stuff like that, as the with the satanic wrestlers or whatever. They're the evil guys against whoever, whether it be Sting or stuff like that. And yeah,
one,
I mean,
the one with Sting and Nikita was on YouTube at some point.
Yeah,
that really, like, you know, the really, like, heavily produced one that was on, like, TBN or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and you talk. Talk about tape trading. Get back to that real quick. There are guys that were underground and still underground that have never had internet presence, and you know
it worked out quite well for them. And we will not name them.
We will not name them, but they still do it to this day, and it's amazing to see that. You know, these guys have been doing it for well over 20 years, and still are successful at what they do. Mm-hmm. So even in 2015, you could, you know, there's still that stuff that goes on that was going on in 1995.
Yep. And I don't want to go too much of a marathon, so I want to finish up in a minute. Just a couple things that we didn't get to cover yet, one of which is near and dear to your heart, but I did mainly just wanted to give a couple minutes to both the Shonen Amaki Post and Wrestling Flyer. So Wrestling Flyer was... the work of long time after this, Philadelphia sportscaster John Clark, and his thing was he was pretty much being the other interview guy besides Wade Keller, but he had arguably better interviews.
Yeah, he was he was also probably a better interviewer than Wade was. Well, although Wade's
nothing
good,
against Wade, and Wade's always gotten good subjects and gotten good interviews and done good interviews, and he's probably a better interviewer than he's ever been. But at the time, like, there's stuff in Wrestling Flyer that's not anywhere else, and of the stuff that's on the ProWrestlingHistory.com kind of collection of stuff, one of the I think there are like two miscellaneous files, and one has the 1993 Wrestling Flyer Annual, which includes not only a round table of things that he asked a bunch of different people in wrestling, name people too, like the same questions about the state of the business, but also a lengthy shoot interview with Sid Vicious where they talk extensively about the stabbing incident with Arn Anderson, which was just not the type of thing that you read in the type of interview that was in the Torch.
Yeah.
And that has come to be one of the hardest newsletters for me to find for some reason. His interview with the Sabu is in one of the chatterboxes too. That's up there. But I don't know why. I mean, I guess it was never one of the big newsletters for whatever reason. I'm kind of, with hindsight, I'm kind of surprised by that. I don't know if we just, because you would think people would value the shoot type interviews more than they, you know what I mean?
I don't know. It's weird because the shoot interviews were really starting at that time. And of course, you know, Feinstein would be after that. But yeah, you would think that something like that would be more appealing.
And he has the only shoot interview with Kerry Von Erich, which he had amazing timing on because he got it when Kerry was right out of rehab in 92.
Yeah. And not too long before his death.
Yeah. But he did some really good work, and he seems like one of those people that just completely wash their hands of wrestling, though, because occasionally I've tried tweeting him to see like if he has that stuff, and he just doesn't reply or sell it or anything.
It's sad people like that they just don't want to acknowledge, you know, that part of their life anymore or whatever.
Yeah. And okay, let's finish by talking about the Shinonomaki Post, a favorite of both of ours, which, what you explain the concept of the Atlanta Boys. Since you saw this all go down in person,
the Atlanta Boys was a faction of guys that would go around to the local shows and sometimes take other road trips.
Most of whom worked in the wrestling business, though.
Yeah, you know, Scott Hudson and Steve Prazak were like the two leaders of the pack, but you also had John Horton, who was Craig Johnson, and you had other guys like Greg Yarman and. Some other guys I can't remember off the top of my head, but
Pedicino would be with them sometimes at the show. Right?
Yeah, Pedicino was like the mentor, I guess you could say, of the group, but he wasn't a member of it. But they eventually put out their own newsletter in 92.
Let's see, because I have them in front of me right here. I think they're all from 93. December 92.
Starting 92 is 93. I mean, November. It was all it was all humor, and it was all
completely made up.
Yeah, all completely made up. There's a heavy emphasis on Chick Donovan, the Golden Boy, it's just one of those things where we talk about how Georgie Ann's newsletter was in its way. There was probably nothing like this one, and it's eccentric, it's cool, it's funny. If you ever have a chance to read any of these, which I don't know if anywhere's got them, or eBay or anywhere, it was just a funny, cool, different read, from guys that were in the business. Like, at the time period, Global was over with, but Scott Hudson, Steve Prazak were still in the business doing stuff with Georgia All-Star Wrestling and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was definitely. I wouldn't say. I guess you could probably say it was a more local thing, but people like, you're a fan of it. It's something that you can be a fan of, but
it's also very of its. Yeah, it's also very of its time, though.
Yeah, it's very of its time, and those guys are great anyway. Great guys,
yes.
And hilarious. So this is like the newsletter version of talking to those guys in person.
Yeah. I know a couple of them John Horton had posted to RSPW at some point that are somewhere on the Google News archive or Google Groups archives. And I have the special collection that he sent to some people a few years ago. I should just ask him if I can post them. I don't think he'd mind, but
yeah,
it's like I'm trying to figure out if there's anything representative that I can pick. Let's pick February 93.
I'm guessing to give you a current example of what it would be, kind of like the Onion of wrestling newsletters.
Sort of, but heavily, mostly focused on WCW and Atlanta Indies.
Yeah, it was definitely localized, but and I remember in that time period, WCW was terrible in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
and the Georgia Indies were just a total mixed bag. So, yeah, it's just a fun read.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of the Sons of Running jokes. Besides, yeah, the Chick Donovan obsession.
Yeah, trying to remember, was it Rip Rogers?
Some Rip Rogers stuff. You had the Bubba Championship Wrestling.
Bubba Championship Wrestling,
where every wrestler was named Bubba.
it's all, you know, parodies and humor. It's just funny. It's just a good laugh.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at. Here we go. News from around the world, wrestling world, from our Wired services. Let's see. Eddie Mansfield now claims he was not the person who appeared on ABC's 2020 Wrestling Exposé in 1985. When asked who in fact had appeared, he said it was the Prince of Darkness himself, Bob Caudle. See, some of it doesn't even make any sense.
There's a lot of inside stuff in there. A lot of inside stuff in there.
I don't even know what the inside joke is there.
Well, no, it's not for us really to know, I think.
Some of it's just hard to tell if it's an inside joke you're not getting or if it just makes no sense.
And the Bob Caudle deal sounds like, you know, Bob Caudle was always known as one of the nicest guys in the wrestling
world. Well, yeah.
And, you know, the Prince of Darkness, Bob Caudle, yeah, that's the joke. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, those guys just had their own sense of humor, their own way. I said the Onion, but I guess I could say Mad Magazine in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah, kind of.
So
a lot of Missy Hyatt stuff, too.
Yeah, a lot of Missy Hyatt stuff, which is understandable. But if you're a fan of Mad Magazine, you'll definitely love this.
Oh, God. The first annual Harley Race Regatta. This is not long after he had his boat crash. Oh, right. They had the Trade and Post.
Yes.
Which was their version of the reader pages. Lanny Poffo and Mike Virgil Jones of No Woman, No Problem Enterprises, 69 Philatia Boulevard, Gag, Connecticut, are selling the home video Get an All Choked Up Through Self-Gratification for $59.95 each. Please state that you are over 12.
For those of you that don't know and don't get the joke, Lanny Poffo and Virgil, Vincent, Soul Train Jones, Mike Jones, were known for having large genitals.
Well, and, that's not the only thing Lanny was known for.
Yeah, and...
Well, now he talks about it.
And he talks about it, but I don't know if Mike Jones ever did this, but I know Lanny definitely wielded himself.
Well, he said he only actually did it once in a locker room, and it just became a thing.
Yeah, but that's quite the thing to be remembered for.
Jimmy Helwig of 2817F Injectable Avenue, Decca, Indiana, is looking for the European version of the Rudolf Nureyev 91 World Tour t-shirt extra large. See, that's just something where there's just no joke to it besides Ultimate Warrior, steroids, and ballet.
It's just hilarious stuff. And it was a short-lived newsletter. So, yeah, it was just a fun thing, man.
Chick Donovan of 4 Geritol Drive, Relic, Georgia, wants a photo of the John Wilkes Booth murder trial. His son is sitting in the third row.
And the Chick Donovan being old jokes are, the dude still wrestles to this day, and he's 77 years old.
Oh, Jesus. How does he look?
I think he's 77, but he looks like Chick Donovan, just older. I wasn't. The dude looks good for his age.
But how does he look like Chick Donovan plus just older? Chick Donovan looked for a long time. He looked the same starting in like 1982.
Well, just add some little wrinkles and a little bit of weight, and you got it.
So in a way, so he's gaining weight, so he's aging in reverse of Jimmy Valiant.
If I link you to a pic, is there a way you can put it up with this show?
Yes.
All right, I'll find the pic of Chick Donovan. And I think Tommy Rich is in this photo, too, from a show that they did in my town a few months ago.
Okay.
And, you'll see what I'm talking about. And Tommy Rich looks like Tommy Rich. He's just older and fatter.
Again, some of these things are just, like, I'm just looking through this. Some of these are just ridiculous puns. Like, you're an American touring Germany. Well, actually, this one's not just a pun, I don't think. You're American touring Germany. You're traveling on the Motherland's Fame Expressway. You're stopped for speeding. Don't panic. Call the experience of Autobahn's Autobahn Autobahns. Let the professionals ensure your release from German custody.
Yeah, it's just, again, just cute stuff, man.
Lots of jokes about working for Global and stuff at times, and that.
Oh yeah, no Global.
But that is a good note to end on. I didn't want this to be too much of a marathon, but being that it's me and you, and we always do long shows, whether it's together or in our general nexus of people, I don't think that's a problem.
This is actually a short show.
This is a short show for the two of us together. Yeah, it is. We're under 2 hours, so that's a new record.
I know the next one I'm doing. The one I'm recording next is going to be a long one, so...
The one you're recording next with me, or the one you're recording... Or the other one you're recording?
The other one I'm recording next.
I don't think you even told me about that one, so we'll talk about that word.
I didn't put it out there. I'm doing a show on Vern Gagne in the AWA.
Oh, no, you did tell me about that.
So, and we're taping this right now on Monday night.
Yes.
And I'm supposed to be taping that on Tuesday night. So, and I have Dylan Hales, of course, your co-host from the Trademarks. And K-Hawk, or Kevin, from Pro Wrestling Only and other areas of wrestling online, who's an AEW historian, one of the top ones. And, you know, with Vern Gagne's passing last week, we figured to go ahead and knock a show out about Vern and AWA. So I got that coming up, and then I got one coming up with you and Dylan about 1988 Crockett and stuff like that. So, yeah. Those shows will probably be really, really long.
Yeah.
Especially the Crockett one.
Do you think we'll go longer than the UWF one?
There's a possibility.
I don't know. It seems like it seems hard to end up going over 3 hours. It seems like usually we can find a way to get it done before 3 hours.
Yeah, but
we'll see. I kind of feel like that's just the point of no return.
Yeah. Well, there's some podcasts I know of, wrestling podcasts, that have gone like four hours lately. And
you saw how long some of those Laps Fan podcasts went?
Yeah. I think the 8 hour shows.
Yes.
Yes, crazy time.
God bless Jack Encarnacio, though. He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
So, I talked about artificially extending podcasts. He said, I talk about podcasts being too long as I artificially extend this podcast with this slow-paced banter. So, let's finish this off for now. So, I guess quickly go over your plugs again, which is Exile on Bad Street Podcast at PlaceToBeNation.com, The Lucha Report. What days is it each week again?
Usually. Normally it's on Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Sometimes that could change over.
And the illustrated version is at the DeathValleyDriver.com.
Yeah, that's the definitive version. But you can also find it all over. I mean, Pro Wrestling Insider has it. Lucha World has it.
Pro Wrestling Insider has it, huh?
Yes, and the Observer,
really?
The Observer has some of the stuff I give to Dave and stuff in the newsletter, and daily updates on the Trigger 4 website. So
yeah, those daily updates, those are fun to read.
Yeah, whenever I get my information on there, it's all. I have those, and Twitter. Yeah, follow me on Twitter because you'll see
Chris
all my.
Elner.
All my goodies on there. Yeah. And like I said, I put the latest episode of Exile up today. So that's if you're a fan of Lucha, that's a good one to watch out for. And we'll do one on the Rudos later on for sure. I mean, that's natural. We got to do the Rudos. But yeah, that's what I got going on right now, and I'm glad the NFL draft's over with, so now I can focus on more stuff that I've been wanting to do.
Yes.
So, because I was doing NFL mock draft on collegefootballzealous.com.
Oh crap! We didn't talk about Matt Watch.
Matt Watch or Steve Beverly.
Should we just go over this, or should we just save it for another
show?
We'll go ahead
and go over real quick.
Okay.
Steve Beverly is a guy who was based at Columbus, Georgia, worked at a TV station in Columbus, very well connected in the television business. And he had a totally different perspective on his newsletter, where he would basically talk about the television side of things, giving full cards for the television shows, the putting up the ratings for the shows, and different stuff like that. So it was a nice companion to The Observer at the time.
Honestly, if just because it's laid out so much nicer while having different information, so I feel like it's the best newsletter of that period overall. Like, the Observer has its own strengths, and I don't think you could have one without the other. Like, you need to read both. And The Torch was coming along, but it wasn't quite... The Torch wasn't quite The Torch as we know it until, like, 91 or 92. But yeah. I don't know if it's just that it's easier to go through and find what I'm looking for, but I really like reading those old Matt Watches. I mean, there's one thing, like, I even save separately just to remember where to look for it. Like, he put together, and it's probably still useful now. I mean, there's some things that are a little out of date. But, like, he put together this incredible, like, it was a glossary of different TV terms that are used commonly talking about wrestling in a TV context. I should just post that somewhere. I mean, because that's just, it explains that stuff so much better, I think, than most people would be able to. And it lasted through, end of 91, and he did this big kind of farewell annual. And, like, a lot of newsletters had annuals back then, as we alluded to a little bit. And it was, like you said, very focused on the TV side. But so he had a review of every TV show, but it wasn't like a full on review. It was just kind of going over whether each episode was worth watching or not. But he had a lot of different information, a lot of different sources, including rumors that a satellite transmission company was going to buy WCW in 1990, I think.
Yeah.
And lots of different stuff. I think I don't have those issues yet, but I believe he was the first person really on top of the specifics of WCW, well, of Turner buying Crockett.
And, you know, funny thing about him was he would eventually become a member of the WCW Hotline.
Yes. And with a segment called Matt Watch with Steve Beverly.
Matt Watch with Steve Beverly, yeah.
And I believe he had, like, the second highest earning segment.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, and eventually Steve gave up the wrestling to become a big-time game show
historian.
And he's still around to this day doing that stuff.
Well, he's kind of given up the mantle a little bit. I don't think he runs his website anymore or anything. But
yeah.
And when he gave up Matt Watch, he brought it back briefly, if I remember correctly. But it was because it was like he admitted it just became too much of a stress on his life, especially having the other full-time job. That, like, you know, he'd get strange harassing messages and stuff. Like first it started, like, someone, I think it started with the type of, like, goofing off people, someone being Black Scorpion on his voicemail or something, but then someone hacking his voicemail.
Yeah.
So he was like, yeah, I gotta give this up. But he put out a hell of a newsletter. One that's oddly hard to find, too, although I'm having better luck with that lately.
Yeah.
And actually, the first three of his four annuals are in one of the MISC files the stuff Jason has up on his site.
Yeah.
So people can see some of that stuff there. And he also put out, well, he didn't put out, but he did his thesis on pro wrestling on TV when he got his master's.
Yeah.
So really, if you can find them and at least read those annuals, because they're really good. But that it was probably the number two newsletter when it was around, though. It was ahead of The Torch.
Yeah.
I mean, in status and everything. So
yeah.
Yes. So we already got your plugs out of the way. So
yeah.
I'm
glad you remember that, because that would have been bad. Yeah.
And it's one.
And I've been on podcasts before where after the show was over with, either me or other people are like, Oh, man, we forgot to mention this.
Well, we decided to do this as one where we weren't going to do notes and keep a loose format, but like then we missed one of like the vital things to talk that we knew we wanted to talk about. But
yeah,
it all worked out. And Raw is actually in its first match now, so I'll finish this up as Xavier Woods, who looks kind of weird without facial hair, puts a headlock on Roman Reigns, who is selling with a face that indicates annoyance more than anything.
Oh, Randy Orton, by the way, we're doing a Raw Live deal here. Randy Orton was just phenomenal in that segment that was just leading into this match.
Well, I lost track of time for a minute, so I'm going to have to go back.
Yeah, he was doing the New Day clap.
Oh, man.
In the ring. And New Day was great, too.
They're tremendous now that they're heels. They're absolutely tremendous now that they're heels.
Yeah, the amazing act, but
So I'll get my plugs in. You know, if you are getting this through iTunes or voicesofwrestling.com or whatever, my site is davidbix.com. You can follow me on Twitter at davidbix. Davidbix.com has all my other stuff, ebook links, has my Twitter feed. It has my Patreon account if you want to donate to support the podcast, or if you want to just, without spending any extra money, if you want to use my Amazon affiliates link, just do your Amazon shopping through that, and I'll get a little percentage as a kickback. That would be nice if you are enjoying these shows. And yes, that's it. And now we're right at 2 hours, so yeah, that's what we get for getting that watch that we had to curse our good fortune there. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening. Thank you, Chris, for joining me. I am sure I will have you back soon, and you will have me back soon, and we'll keep doing that little dance. So that's it. Until next week, this is The Big Show, and see you next... What the hell is Roman Reigns do? Oh, God. Oh, thank God. I thought he was going to put on a sharpshooter wrong.
They're in Montreal.
Okay. Oh, yeah, they are. Okay, yeah, so yes, you'll be able to tell exactly when we were recording this based on that little moment there. So yes, thanks everyone for listening. I'll go into the theme song now, which Chris will not be able to hear because, of course, I add that after the fact. So until then, in the words of Jim Ross, so long, everybody. Fix.